scene said scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn. It was rocking. It was rocking.
Hello, I'm Louis Jordan. No, 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 I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Leah Jordan. No, 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 I'm Leah Gilmore.
And welcome to
And it's rockin'. That's right.
Louis Jordan, Saturday
That's
Night
right.
Fish Fry.
Oh, yeah, I can't tell you how many times I heard my father playing that one.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, what a show we're going to have.
It's good to see you, Leah.
It's good to see you, too.
Good to have you back in the studio. I know you're tired. Been rolling around the world.
Yeah,
singing.
I've been home 3 days from France,
Siberia, and Paris. Give me a break. But of course, this means our once a month visit from Leah Gilmore, who is the Center for Emerging Media's cultural editor and award winning singer, musician, senior fellow for justice, social justice at the Deutsche Foundation as well, here in Baltimore, part of her day job. And she joins us. It's always good to have you co-hosting here, Leah.
It is always good to be here. I'm thrilled. Thanks.
And we are joined now by Dr. Glenn Altshuler, who is the Littman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University and wrote the book All Shook Up, How Rock and Roll Changed America. And the great Ramblin' Rose. Rosa Pryor joins us. She was a columnist for the Afro Baltimore Times. And Rosa Pryor and Glenn Altshuler, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Rosa, are you on? This is Leah Gilmore. I'm thrilled to talk to you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. It's been so long.
It's been too long.
Whoa, it goes back a long, long way. Baltimore Times. Jesus.
Baltimore, that's right. But when I thought about who knows Baltimore music scene more than anyone else, your name was right on top.
Well, I appreciate that. And it's such a pleasure to be among such prestigious guests that you have.
Oh, my goodness. I guess that doesn't include me. And Dr. Altshuler, it's so nice to have you here as well. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here, even though I'm not Louis Jordan.
Okay. we'll be Louis Jordan today.
We'll do it.
But can you, Louis Jordan was so instrumental in kind of bridging the blues and rock and roll. What is your take on the importance of Louis Jordan? To me, he's pivotal.
Well, he was the exponent of what was then called the jump blues, and he played alto sax with Louis Armstrong, with Chick Webb, and then, of course, he had his own combo called the Timpani Five. And he is, without question, one of the great progenitors of rhythm and blues that, of course, became rock and roll. Great performer.
And even comes through on YouTube for those of us who are not yet born.
All of us.
I wasn't there. They needed me.
Mark. Okay.
Not for Louis Jordan.
Not for Louis Jordan. Yeah, you were a little baby there.
Many others. But, I mean, I think this is, let me just give our guests and our listeners at 410-319-8888 and write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. The reason we're doing this show. We're doing this show because the last time Leah was on, we had this conversation about music in America and the roots of music in America.
Right.
And my riff on dichotomy, and which I'll talk about in a bit, and Leah's riffing on exploitation.
On structural racism.
And how these two fit together, which we want to get into in this conversation, but also kind of celebrate what really is the heart and soul of popular music in America and where it comes from. And I think that was really at the heart of this conversation about what is at the heart and soul of...
What's at the heart and soul, and really appreciating and acknowledging what the heart and soul of rock and roll is, and that this was a form that was created originally by African Americans. To me, it's a bit of a microcosm of race relations in America in general.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Schuller?
Altshuler.
Dr. Altshuler. Okay. Well, comment on that.
Well, there's no question that what became rock and roll has its origins in rhythm and blues music, what was called race music.
Yeah, race records.
With race records, with some bows toward gospel and blues. and that as it became more commercialized in the 1950s, it became appropriated to some degree by white performers. Now, that doesn't mean that there was not a broad understanding of where it came from in many circles, but commercialization did involve, to some degree, the bleaching of the music and the changing, especially of some of the more earthy themes and vernacular language, and a kind of homogenization of some of the music as well. Now, I say that, and I'm sure we will want to get into this more. That doesn't mean that there weren't great white rock and roll performers as well as African American rock and roll performers.
Exactly. Exactly. You have a question?
Well, no, I was thinking, and I'm going to get Rosie in this, your thoughts as well on this, Rosa. I mean, because you cover music. How would you respond to Leah's question?
Well, myself, people label me as historian, and I'm not. And like Leah said, it's mostly my personal experience and growing up. I'm 70 years old, so I remember rock and roll consists of music from the 50s, mostly white musicians such as Elvis Presley, Jerry Lewis, Lee Lewis, rather, Bill Haley and the Comets, Johnny Cash. And I remember listening to music from that era, from these particular, some of these particular musicians and entertainers. Now, there was a few blacks during that era, I believe, remembering is artists such as Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, and it seems to me that during that time it was the best time of life. I'm a music lover. I used to sing professionally, and I was kind of enjoying that type of music. Even Louis Jordan, because of my father, you know. And a big band. I mean, my father played the records over and over and over and over again. I don't think they even...
Oh, you must have lived in my house, Rosa.
Oh, my God. When I woke up in the morning till the time I went to bed.
That's right.
He worked at Spurs Point, but Lord have mercy on his days off. I mean, I believe that, you know, he had that before breakfast was playing that music. But I believe that my thing is rock and roll kind of died out slowly with the artists. As they passed on, as the artists passed, and other artists got ill and older. So I think during that, that's when the time, I believe, that the term rock and roll kind of left the era and came into something like rhythm and blues, in the term of rhythm and blues.
It's almost hard to separate it. You know, rock and roll, I know in our community, was a vernacular for, you know, rocking and rolling. Dr. Archul, I'll let you talk about that a little bit.
Well,
but I have a quote from Little Richard. It says, "It started out as rhythm and blues," says Little Richard, the flamboyant rock pioneer who saw such tumultuous songs of his as Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally taken to the charts in white bread cover versions by the likes of Pat Boone. There wasn't nobody playing it at the time but black people, myself, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry. White kids started paying more attention to this music. White girls were going over to this music. They needed somebody to come in, and there came Elvis. What do you say to that?
Well, I go ahead, and then I'll chime in.
No, she just was good.
No, I'm done.
Oh, we have the phenomenon of covering of songs that you talked about, and also about crossover appeal. And crossover appeal is very important in the commercialization of rock and roll. Rock and roll is a term that was used in music from the 20s.
Yeah.
And it means different things to different people. It has a sexual connotation in the minds of some. It became popularized, of course, by the white DJ Alan Freed, who gave rock and roll that name. That doesn't mean he invented it, but he was the one who spread it. And Alan Freed was always clear about the African-American origins.
Yeah, he was a proponent. He was big time.
Very strong proponent of African-American artists, no question about it. And I guess I would also just say here, to complicate things a little bit, that artists have always covered one another's music and borrowed, learned from, borrowed and copied one another. And that's not necessarily, a good thing or a bad thing. You know, Ray Charles, for example, has always said, I believe in mixed musical marriages. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to copyright a feeling or a rhythm or a style of singing. And I think that's true. I think what we often react to, and justifiably so, is that African-American artists did not benefit in proportion to their contributions to
exactly.
the music of
exactly.
rock and roll.
And that's
not that
crucial.
There's anything wrong with
right.
white artists
right.
playing rock and roll, and Elvis Presley was a very gifted artist,
right.
at least in my view. But it's the disproportionate benefits, mm-hmm. Especially from the 1950s, which mm-hmm. is a golden era, or the first golden age of rock and roll, that I think do legitimately trouble folks.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. Yeah. It's the disproportionate nature and the structural. So that is definitely the structural racism that was around it. You know, was it, I think we're hearing some music
this
now.
This is Wanoni Harris, and we
right.
were playing his music is because people credit this song with coming up with the term rock and roll.
Yeah.
Back in 1947 when he first put this
but
sound
it was
out.
But rock and roll was even being talked about in the 20s.
Yeah, but
yeah,
but
you know?
They're saying that his song was the first song to really push the word rockin' in mm-hmm. his song. But one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking was if you take Lieber and Stoller, Lieber was from Baltimore,
right?
And
right.
they wrote "Hound Dog" for Big Mama Thornton, right? And Michael Lesko has a book out about Baltimore, and one of the quotes he has in there is Stoller calling Lieber, saying, "Hound Dog is going number one." And Lieber went, "Big Mama Thornton sitting number one?"
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller says, "No, some white kid shaking his hips in Mississippi."
That's right.
Named Elvis. And uh-huh. so on the one hand, people like Lieber and Stoller who were in the music business, writing songs, making this connection with black artists, was on one level a very honest and open relationship. With another level, though, this was also part, I would posit, part of the kind of the exploitative side of the music industry, where the artists being pushed became white, and then white became synonymous with rock and roll, and black folks became synonymous with nothing but blues.
Right.
You know, I mean, so there was this shift that took place in America when
it
in terms
was
of
a
what
curious, curious shift. I think, again, Mark, that is exactly right. I know Lenny Kravitz said when he tried to get his music played, which is still, on feeling like rock and roll in the 80s when he was trying to shop record labels, it kept sending them to black departments like the In Living Color, the Black Rock Band. And they started a coalition called Black Rock Coalition in 1985, which declared rock and roll is black music and we are its heirs. And they play totally rock music, totally what we think is rock music. I don't think it's really, Dr. Shuler and Rosa, it's not the artist. It is the atmosphere by which we live in. People were uncomfortable with this black guy saying "Tutti Frutti Good Booty," So they changed the roots to Tutti Frutti Go Rudy, you know. I mean, their poor white girls were right. being subjugated to this this overly sexualized thing. But the thing about it was just good music, but we lived in a racialized society. And when you have a song like, when you have an experience like Big Mama Thornton singing Hound Dog and it being huge in the black community, and then Elvis singing Hound Dog and she dying in abject poverty and Elvis dying, although not prettily, quite wealthy. I mean, it's kind of indicative of how things went. Comments?
It's my job maybe to try to complicate things, just a little bit.
It's not complicating. Just say.
Right. No,
to me, it's complicated. Maybe not to you. When you're seeking a mass market, as record companies did, that's all you're doing, and it often means that you acquiesce to that market, and if that market is going to respond more to a white singer covering a song, that's what you do. And therefore, we know what the relative size of the population was in the 1950s. We know what the purchasing power was for many people. And so even though it's regrettable and no question about that, it's quite understandable that those people whose job is to make a buck are going to not fight but acquiesce to those kinds of market realities.
Right. And
and that's what happened.
I don't think that's complicated. I just think that's a fact.
Yeah, you know,
and I think
that's not complicated at all.
It's the unfortunate fact, given the racial dynamics of the time, not just the population, but also the dynamics of the time period and some of the time period that we spend now. Sam Phillips, he swore he didn't say this, but he's so attributed with saying, if I could find a white man who had the Negro sound and the Negro feel, I could make $1 billion. And you know, well,
right.
He sold off his rights to RCA, so RCA made the $1 billion. You know, but
what we do know to be true is that when Dewey Phillips first played, no relation to Sam Phillips, when Dewey Phillips first played Elvis's records, and he called Elvis in to the studio, he made sure that Elvis indicated what high school he had gone to signal the listeners that he was white.
Exactly. I remember reading that. You're right.
At that time. And it was designed, I don't think there's any question about it, to make those white listeners more comfortable,
exactly,
both in listening to that music and ultimately then in buying the records. And certainly that was part of the set of racial realities in the South, but it was also, of course, as we all know, the racial realities in the North as well.
Right. And we call it up North. You know, up South, rather.
Up South.
We're
up
listening
south.
Now to Little Richard singing Tutti Frutti. You know, I love that. I used to walk around the house singing that. I had no idea what he was talking about until my father said, don't sing that song. But it would be great to hear Pat Boone's version right after this.
Of Tutti Frutti?
Of Tutti Frutti.
Okay.
Okay.
It'd be good to hear Pat Boone. Not that I'm a huge Pat Boone fan, but yeah, let's hear a little Pat Boone. But I mean, I as we're getting ready for Pat Boone, let me push the envelope a little bit here. So I would posit everything that that you were just saying, Glenn Altschuler, is correct. However, I think that it also, I don't think that people just always acquiesce to markets. I think American capitalism is also about creating markets they want to create. And we create markets in this country. We just don't acquiesce to them.
Well, we created the race record market. And after not believing that black people would even buy music.
Right.
It was created because they saw potential after 1920 Mabel Smith's Crazy Blues.
Exactly. And that I think that this is part of a larger kind of historical issue of kind of systemic exploitation and racism that happened in this country when it came to everything we did, whether it was you going back to jazz and jazz becoming an art form that people didn't want to pay attention to until a white artist came in and they had Benny Goodman with his first interracial band that, you know, made his first concert near Carnegie Hall, and mm-hmm. then it started picking up. And so I think that's the history of what fuels this in America is something we can't ignore, which is so much the popular music coming out of slavery and the kind of joy of music being an antidote to the oppression people were in, and creating the popular music that became America's music against oppression in many ways itself.
Right.
So I think that's something that, even though there was an acquiescence to market, I think that there's something a lot more powerful pushing it all than just that.
I think we just said the same thing. It is a systematic racism that exists that creates it. Please, Rosa.
It's also, I believe, it's the era of time, you know, consisting back from the 50s, because my thought is on, as far as rock and roll and the rhythm and blues, there was the doo-wops, and that's my favorite, and that came in the era of the 50s, 30s and 40s, really, it started. Mm-hmm. And the doo-wop is still around, which started back at that time. They are still playing their songs in certain media, and like the Ink Spots, Sonny Till and the Orioles, the Clovers, the Platters, the Coasters, Pookie Hudson and the Spaniels, all black artists, and mm-hmm. And even the Swallows locally from Baltimore.
Yeah.
I remember
the
Swallows.
The Dynamics of Pearls.
Right.
These kind of trend off from the rock and roll era, but they also, the doo-wops was back there in the 30s and the 40s, which started, and mostly was black. Like I said, it's the era, I believe, mostly was the era as far as some of the whites, doo-wops, as well as the black, they kind of shared the stage, but the whites was getting more than the African-Americans.
I have to jump in here just to say we have to take a quick break. We'll come right back, Glenn. I'm going to let you come right back in.
Thank you.
And we're going out here. We just heard Pat Boone.
Yes, we did.
And his attempt at Tutti Frutti. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Let's look at the history of rock and roll.
Sing it, Big Mama.
Go ahead, Leah Gilmore. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are here with Rosa Pryor, columnist of the Afro and Baltimore Times,
yes.
Dr. Glenn Altshuler, a Lupin professor of American Studies at Cornell University, who wrote the book All Shook
yeah,
Up,
he's
How Rock and Roll Changed America. And before we go back to our conversation, I have to remind you of one thing very important for the future of this show. This Mark Steiner show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go, of course, go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner. It is there. And we came back, of course, with...
I think Dr. Shuler has a comment.
With Ball
us.
And Chain, Big Mama Thornton. And
who
before we went to break,
singing?
Glenn, you were going to say what?
Yes, I was going to point out that, at least in my view, it's important also to recognize that rock and roll paved the way for African American performers to go commercial. If you take a look at the music before rock and roll that had widespread commercial appeal, it's more like Patti Page and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. It's very white. Rock and roll, even as it succumbed to race discrimination, also provided an avenue for African American performers to become much more well-known and much more successful. And if you compare music and African-American performers' role in it, let's say to movies or television, you'll see that popular music, at least in my judgment, is somewhat ahead of those other popular culture forms in the way in which they feature African-American performers. And then move ahead to the 60s and 70s and look at the role of African-American singers, rock and roll singers, and you begin to get a sense of rock and roll also opening some doors. That has to be part of the story as well.
Well,
By the way, we're hearing Howlin' Wolf right now under
Howlin'
us,
Wolf.
Just to let you all know, it's just a backdoor man.
Backdoor man. Wonder what that means, Mark.
I have no idea.
I bet you don't. Okay. Hey, but you know what? The Doors also covered Backdoor Man. But this is a Howlin' Wolf song. I mean, Glenn, I think you make a good point. And when you talk about commercial and going pop, and I mean, we're definitely talking about being seen on the white charts, on the big grander charts than the R&B charts, where many of these people were already extremely famous folks. Like, for instance, some of the co-opting is amazing to me, and maybe the borrowing and whatever. But Big Joe Turner, Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
Oh, yeah.
Later, Bill Haley in the Comets, Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Shake It Up Baby by the Beatles, the Isley Brothers. That's Shake It Up Baby. They did it first, you know, that was that thing. Big Mama Thornton, Ball and Chain, she wrote it. Janis Joplin, who she had the huge hit with it, Ball and Chain. There are countless stories where the white artists reap the benefits of songs that were created and written in the black community. That being said, again, I don't always think it's the artist. As artists, we all work together.
Right.
I mean, my band is multicultural, and many bands are. It is not the artist. It is the companies reacting to the commercialization, to what is commercially pliable for them at the time.
And Rosa, Rosa, you were about to say something. I can hear you saying something. What were you saying, Rosa?
I agree with what Leah just said. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, let me just add that.
Well, let me let Rosa finish first.
It is definitely not the artist. I believe it's the industry and what they wish to promote and how they can make money in the industry according to the era that they are producing the music to. That include the radio stations all around the country.
Uh-huh.
It's dependent on the audience that they're performing for, and they play the records accordingly, and that again has something to do with the industry, the record company, the radio stations that plays them. It has nothing that I believe, as Leah said, has absolutely nothing to do with the artists, because they get along, they play with each other, they enjoy each other,
and there's a mutual respect,
and they work with each other to write music together. So it is the industry.
410-319-8888, folks. Join us with your thoughts on the history of rock and roll, the history of our music and culture. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Or log into our Facebook pages, 410-319-8888. Give us your thoughts right now. So, and you were about to say, what, Glenn? Then I have another thought I want to throw out to all three of you.
Why don't you go ahead and throw out that thought, and then I'll try.
Fine. Why don't I do that? So, you know, one of the things I think is also this is an interesting phenomenon, because there's this question of systemic racism and exploitation, which is profound in America and is part of the culture. And I've told, as I lectured to a bunch of college students in the last few weeks, that part of their struggle in this 21st century is going to be they'll be the ones to change that, because it's going to be their battle to deal with this institutionalized issue. And having said that, I was thinking that America could not ignore, white America, corporate America, could not ignore the power of black culture that came out of this country. And I think what's happened in explaining it, but could not ignore it, while I was explaining
it's not ignorable.
But right. But,
exploiting, like you said, right, that's possible.
And so, but I think what's happening now in the 21st century, what's happened in the last 50 years is that African-American culture has become the predominant influence in popular American culture and is transforming consciousness just by its very presence
the world.
In America. And I think that's a part of this as well. So it's like almost as if Big Mama Thornton and Little Richard and other folks are coming back and Howlin' Wolf saying, okay, 67 years later, but it's now coming, it's not just race music coming in being sold as white music, it's now transforming the heart of American culture. That's what I'm going to posit at the moment and see what you all say about that.
Well, to me, that's a very important point. And just as we have an obligation to understand and remember the discrimination and racism that defined American society and constrained African-American performers in the 1950s, we also, I think, have to recognize the emergence of African-American culture and its influence on both American culture and world culture,
right.
How that happened,
right.
And part of that, in my
exactly.
judgment, is attributable to rock and roll. That rock and roll didn't just discriminate, it also opened some doors.
I can't agree with you more there, Glenn. I know that's shocking, right? But but let me tell you why.
I agree with them too.
I have done many panels and lectures and spoken to young people, older people, where they said, I learned about Muddy Waters because I was really into the Stones, you know, mm-hmm. or any, just name a group, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd, I heard sing this, so I came back and listened to Howlin' Wolf. It did the reverse as well as not just being an object of discrimination, but being a door that opened that wouldn't have opened unless they had some type of access to it via the popular culture. So I think you are right on point about that. And also, there's some just darn good music that came out of it, period. I mean, there's some very good music, but I think we would be remiss. As I said, I was just in France 4 days ago, and I was on a panel talking about African-American music. And we here in America would be amazed at the influence of African-American indigenous music, the influence that it has across the world, the Palestinian hip-hop, the blues. My blues band is Italian. They're from Genoa, you know? They've never been to the States, but they play like they were somewhere from Clarksdale, Mississippi. You know, the influence is so important, yet they don't have the shadow of the structural racism that exists here. I mean, racism's everywhere. So who they talk about are the black artists.
Right.
They always reference the black artists. You rarely hear them talking about the Rolling Stones. I love the Rolling Stones, by the way. The Rolling Stones or other groups. They talk about Big Mama Thornton, Howlin' Wolf, Dinah Washington. I mean, these are their huge heroes. Wu-Tang Clan, I'm moving up in the world now in the time. You know, the rappers now. And so it really is interesting how you'd have to go outside of the way that we're structured here.
Yes.
You know, because we are built on structural racism. We're built on it.
Yeah.
To see how it is appreciated around the country and how they know who it comes from.
Let me go right to the phone show, because people are calling in at 410-319-8888. And Eric, you're in Baltimore. I mean, Eric in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Eric in Baltimore.
And we're listening to Maybelline, Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Eric, you're on the air. Welcome.
Eric, are you there? Well, Maybelline is there.
All right, well, we can get Eric and our callers back on. Let's try to do that. 410-319-8888.
Right.
We will get you in here if humanly possible. Rock and roll is synonymous with America.
Yeah.
When people think of a musical form, you know, some of us will think of jazz because that is the American classical music. But when people think, most people popularly think about America, they think about rock and roll.
They think about blues.
Right.
Don't forget my doo-wop.
Doo-wop is extremely popular in Europe, Rosa. Yeah. I just have to tell you that.
Fantastic. Okay. That is my favorite. But, you know, all in all, I believe music from whether it be rock and roll, rhythm and blues, as they want to call it, and whether it be jazz, doo-wop, I've always believed with all my heart that music is a weaving thread.
Amen.
To bring all cultures Amen. Together, no matter what part of the world you live in. Is something about music as general that brings people together. It doesn't matter what color, what race they be, or what background they came from, or what country they come mm-hmm. from. Music seems to be the main instrument to bring these things together.
I mean, and
I think you're so right.
And the biggest music in the world was came out of the United States, and its roots are blues and rock. I mean, that's what has captured the imagination, the
and
soul, the feeling.
And the reason why is because it's music of the soul. It's music
yes.
of the heart. It's not a cerebral experience.
Right.
And our hearts and souls don't have color.
No.
You know, we don't laugh in white and cry in black. Mm. We are the ones who create this underlying structure of commercialism. But the music, once you're putting it out there, Glenn and Rosa, while you're doing it, it's not a commercial experience.
That's true.
You know, it is something that sometimes we can over-intellectualize, but it truly is that weaving. I think that's a brilliant way to say it.
And Glenn, I'm curious, having read some of the things you've written about, what you think was the overarching influence and power of rock and roll in American culture? What, I mean, how do you think it, what role,
that's a good question.
What role did it play in transforming us as?
Well, in the 1950s, I think what was very important about rock and roll is that first, it was the first music that was sung by young people to young people.
Yes.
And it began to identify young people as a separate class of people mm-hmm. with their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it was the music of lowering inhibitions, of a greater amount of freedom. It had a kind of anti-establishment, albeit a modest one, a connection to it. And in that respect, it was different from other forms of popular culture. And in that sense as well, rock and roll in the 50s is a little bit of a precursor to some of the cultural and political movements of the 1960s. And that gives it a certain importance. And I would also, if I may, just add that one of the reasons I think that that rock and roll served, I think, to open some doors, as we've talked about, is that listening to it on the radio allowed whites to enjoy African Americans in a way that they often weren't permitted to do.
That's right.
In physical proximity.
Amazing point.
Yeah.
And that to me is very important
right.
as well.
Amazing
right.
point. That I think that is a crucial point.
I have a question.
Sure. Go right ahead.
For either one of you to answer, do you believe that rock and roll is now history, consider as history, or is it present or in our future to continue, you know?
I'm going to vote present. And
I'm going to go present. I think rock and roll is still here. I think we changed it. I think just like house music and disco, it's like the same music. We just changed music. We changed titles generationally.
Okay.
You know, a lot of times. But I believe that that era of rock and roll was that era
right.
of rock and roll.
Okay.
And because before we leave, I'm going to ask one of the musics we play on. We're listening to Lucille right now by Little Richard, of course, playing.
Mm-hmm.
But I talking about today's era, there's somebody I've been listening to a lot. Maybe we can pull herself up in that. Is Valerie June. We have a piece by her.
Oh, yeah.
And we're talking about new sounds mm-hmm. coming out that marry rock and roll, country, And she's clearly one of those.
And there's so many black artists that are doing that. I mean, the younger generation, Dionne Ferris, Tracy Chapman, Desiree, Terrence Trent D'Arby, Ben Harper, Michelle and Dale Gale Ocello. All of these don't fit into black squares anymore, you know. We've really come to a point where, you know, music is really becoming more music than categories.
I agree.
That's a good thing.
Now, Eric, do you think it's dead or alive since you wrote the book, or one of the books anyway?
Glenn.
Sorry.
I think this is a very important point, that musical genres are now blending into one another.
Yes.
And it's much more difficult to identify something as rock and roll or country or blues. It was easier to do that in the 50s, easy to do it during the British invasion in the 60s. Since the 70s, it's more difficult to do it, it seems to me. And the name, I think, means something less and more than it meant in the 50s and 60s. So we call a lot of things rock and roll, but I would say the word and the genre in and of itself maybe has a little less power than it had when it was also new.
And it was also a product of segregation back then as well. I mean, it was living in a different world. But rock and roll, some people still identify as rock and rollers out there.
That's it.
You know?
Yeah.
They sure are.
And the one we're hearing right now, Valerie June, Working Woman Blues.
Yeah.
Grew up in a church in Memphis, but she brings in these artists and acts that are combining all kinds of music to create her own piece.
Right.
Rock
and
roll.
That's what we do.
That's what it's.
Black folks and Celtic music.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
That's what I do.
Right.
Right.
That stuff is powerful. I think that this is again one of our powerful looks at culture we've had here on the Mark Steiner Show, especially when my dear friend and colleague Leah Gilmore is in the house co-hosting. And I think that my producer just wrote in, I think it's definitely almost irrelevant with youth culture, totally eclipsed by other kinds of music like hip hop, electronic, and pop. He thinks rock and roll is irrelevant. I don't know. That's we'll maybe pick up that next thing.
Yeah,
I'm not so sure if I agree with that.
I absolutely do not agree with that.
But that's okay.
That's okay.
Young people speak.
Yes. Young person spoke.
Yeah.
But I think that the roots of much of that is rock and roll. I do want to thank Glenn Altshuler for taking his time with us today, Lippman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University, author of the book All
thank
Shook
you
Up.
Thank you so much, Glenn.
How Rock and Roll Changed America. Glenn, was great having you with us.
Mm-hmm. Pleasure meeting all of you, even virtually.
Yes,
virtually. And Rosa Pryor?
Rosa, yes. Thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate
and
you.
And I sure
Mark,
hope
and
we
and
see
Leah.
Each other soon.
Yes, thanks for the invite. I truly, you know, it was so much fun. Thank you so
great
much.
Great to hear
thank
your voice,
you.
Rosa Pryor.
Yes.
And she's a legend here in Baltimore.
And thanks for all the writing you do and stuff you do for us here in Baltimore.
Yes.
Thank you.
And my
thank
dear,
you all.
Thank you all, Glenn. And my dear friend, Leah Gilmore.
My dear friend, Mark Steiner.
Thank you for co-hosting with me.
Thank you.
I love this thing we do together.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, huh?
So Leah will be back next month in the midst of all of her traveling.
I will be back next month, and she will not be traveling.
Hello, this is good. So we're going out with Link Ray's The Rumble.
All right.
That's a classic. Speaking of classic, we're about to talk to the classic Baynard Woods, senior editor of the City Paper, see what's in this issue. Stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back.